From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. South African comedian Trevor Noah took over from Jon Stewart on The Daily Show in September. What a time to take that chair. The young comic from Soweto stepping into the one of the wildest American presidential campaign seasons ever, and into some big shoes. This hour On Point, Trevor Noah of The Daily Show with Trevor Noah is with us. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How have you sized up Trevor Noah and his Daily Show? Do you know his incredible backstory? When he takes the mic, what's the perspective you hear? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Trevor Noah's first day as host of The Daily Show, September last year, he spoke directly to Jon Stewart.
I'm not quite sure what you saw in me, but I'll work hard every day to find it. And I'll make you not look like the crazy old dude who left his inheritance to some random kid from Africa. And to you, the Daily Show viewer, both new and old, at home or on your phone, thank you for joining us as we continue the war on...
And that was September. Now he's deep in it. Here he was in March, just after he endorsed Texas Senator Ted Cruz for the GOP nomination. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham came on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. He explained that he endorsed Cruz because he hates Trump so much. Here, Graham, and then Trevor Noah.
His campaign is opportunistic, race baiting, religious bigotry, xenophobia. Other than that, he'd be a good nominee.
Here's a question I have for you, though.
And we're about to lose the most dishonest woman in America.
Here's the thing. If you say Donald Trump is not a Republican, why does it seem like the Republican base fits him like a glove? What's going on? Do the voters not know that this, or have you maybe given them the impression that maybe this is a party that supports xenophobia and bigotry and all of those things you listed? Is that possible?
Joining me now from New York is Trevor Noah, host of Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. He's currently on tour for his stand-up comedy show with stops coming up in Foxwoods, Connecticut, Nashville, Detroit, and many more. Trevor Noah, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
Thanks for being here. How on earth do you find time to go out on tour? I don't get it. Aren't you on the air, you know, practically every day of the week?
Yeah, practically every day of the week, Monday through Thursday. But, I mean, weekends I have off, and so I choose to use those weekends relaxing. Some people go fishing. I do stand-up comedy.
You're all over the place. You're Antwerp and Oslo and Stockholm and Amsterdam and then Detroit and Jamestown, New York and Saratoga, California and Denver. What does it do for you, Trevor Noah, to get out of the studio and back on the stage, live stage?
Well, it does multiple things for me. I mean, in the U.S., the biggest thing it does for me is it gives me an opportunity to see a lot of the places that I speak about. So I've never been a fan of making sweeping judgments or general assumptions about places or people. So I love to travel, you know, go to different cities, feel what the people are like, eat the food, hang out, go to the museums. I mean, I can't learn everything in a weekend when I'm there, but it just gives me a sense of what America is on the ground. Because a lot of the time, especially if you live on the coast, you can get absorbed in a certain point of view or a certain perspective. And, you know, if you're reading, the biggest newspapers, you think you're tapped in. But when you go to certain places in America, you realize there are different perspectives, there are different views. And when you hear them from people, I think sometimes it starts more of a conversation than a fight.
Are you having a good time, Trevor, with this? I mean, this is a big job. Jon Stewart made it into a huge thing. He handed it to you. You're in the thick of this crazy campaign season. Are you enjoying it?
I'm loving it. How could you not? I mean, I mean, there are moments of terror that I cannot deny, but I mean, that's what makes a good horror movie, the moments of terror, and then you hope at the end everyone walks out alive. So, I mean, I'm enjoying it for what it is. You know, it is a time when I feel like satire is definitely needed, and it's fantastic to be on The Daily Show. You know, it's fantastic to be a part of this American cycle. I mean, this election is ridiculous.
What's a moment of terror for you? I mean, anybody who works in public has them. What does it mean for you on The Daily Show?
I think for me it's those moments where you come to realize that people are willing to go above and beyond just the rhetoric, you know? When you are standing watching the TV and you are seeing riots and clashes and people turning – what was just at one point a vibrant discussion into a physical altercation, and you see people, you know, viscerally attacking other human beings. That's when I start to get a little bit worried. That's when you realize, you know, we may be reaching a place of no return, or the damage might be so bad that the return may take a long time.
Are you still getting your American education? I mean, you really are a kid of South Africa, a kid from Soweto. This is a long way from that. And what, you're 32 years old now, something like that?
Yes, yeah.
But that means by far the most of your life in that African context. How do you feel about being in, living in, talking to the U.S. at this point?
Well, there's two things that are great about coming to the U.S. for me. One, we have a very similar history to the United States and South Africa, you know, colonial history, history of oppression, you know, history of tense race relations. So in that regard, I feel like I'm home to a certain extent. I understand a lot of these things. Also, you know, America permeates cultures all over the world. So no matter where you are very in touch with America. I grew up watching you know, Steve Urkel, and I grew up watching The Jeffersons, and I grew up watching all of these shows. I was watching Murder, She Wrote and Rescue 911 with my mom. So as much as we've grown up in a completely different world, how we were informed was largely shaped by American culture and politics. So coming here is not completely foreign. And if anything, I feel like I've done it the right way. Isn't that what America was founded on? It was people who came from a different place to learn how to be American on a different land.
Trevor Noah, right up front on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, calls right here for you. Trevor, Laurel in Hampton, Virginia. You're on with Trevor Noah. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say, with Trevor, you know, you had some big shoes to fill there with Jon Stewart. I love Jon Stewart. But you not only filled them, you kicked him off and laid back and had his slippers on. You are really, really funny, and you do a great job on that show. I just love you. So
thank you so much.
I mean, sorry, John, you know, but...
Anyway,
I just wanted to say that.
Laurel, we've got it. If that's too harsh a criticism, Trevor, we're really sorry about it.
No. You know what the funny thing is, though? I came to realize, and John and I joke about this all the time, and the truth is I understand the sentiment, and, you know, it's like, oh, you have to fill John Stewart's shoes. I always say to him, though, I go, but you're still wearing your shoes. You know, John Stewart is still around. He has not died. He is going to be joining us again. He's going to be making a new show in a different way. So what's fantastic is, you know, the people haven't lost John Stewart. You know, and we always joke about that. So if anything, I'm trying to create new shoes, which is very difficult. But I understand there was a legacy that was left behind. But yeah, I mean, the most amazing thing for me is people who have gone, hey, we can appreciate both of you. And that's what I think we've lost a lot of in society, the ability to say, I can like more than one thing at the same time.
Interesting to be talking with you this week, a week in which Jon Stewart has kind of emerged, at least to most of us, for the first time in a long time in Chicago. He was on David Axelrod's show, The Axe Files. And, of course, he had the man-baby business. He asked if Donald Trump was even eligible. This is your predecessor, Jon Stewart, to be president. He posed the question.
Are you eligible to run if you are a man baby? Or a baby man? I don't know. And again, I'm not here to be politically incorrect. If they're referred to as man baby Americans, but he is a man baby. He has the physical countenance of a man and a baby's temperament and hands. So,
Jon Stewart, of course, man baby all over the place now. How do you see your view of the world vis-a-vis John's when it comes to looking at American politics, maybe a good way to start? Do you have a similar, the same, something quite different? You've thought a lot about it, I'm sure. How do you see it, Trevor?
I think the biggest difference between myself and John is just where we came from. Where we're trying to get to is very similar. That's what drew us together. So with any issue, we find we get to the same place or we draw a similar conclusion, but it's just our formula that we use to get there is informed by completely different things. You know, John Stewart, as he says, is a Jersey boy through and through. You know, and didn't really travel much, and he was like, this is how I form my views and opinions. And over the years, he read and grew into a worldly figure, but from the confines of The Daily Show. Whereas I guess I spent many years shaping my views and opinions traveling the world, you know. So if anything, you still get to the same place. It's just we have very different ways of getting there. And I think that's what's exciting, is that I'm still trying to, you know, fulfill the legacy of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, but then in a slightly different way, through a slightly different prism.
Do you feel the freedom to do that, or do you feel the old appetite that was, molded over his many years in that chair, demanding something that you have to fulfill?
Well, there is definitely an appetite for that. So I understand that completely. You know, if people have been enjoying that for many years, for some people, most of their adult lives, I understand that completely. But at the same time, you have to do what you have to do. You know, John told me stories of how people didn't want him to replace Craig Kilborn, which in hindsight looks ridiculous. Everyone goes, that's not possible. But that's the truth. And so I understand that. People love John Stewart. And you know, you have to create a new audience of people that love you and people that love the both of you as well. So there is that appetite. But I have to explain to people that, hey, you know, there are different styles of satire, and the way in which you go about approaching the material may vary slightly. So I have never been an extremely abrasive person. I've always used satire in a different way to try and, I guess, expose the folly rather than to create an enemy of the person I'm speaking about. So I think there are different ways to do it, many ways to skin a cat.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Daily Show host Trevor Noah, 7+ months after he took over from Jon Stewart, about the show, the world, and the Trevor Noah take on all that. You can join us this hour. Can you imagine the journey from Soweto to that chair, the host's chair of The Daily Show? And what's your question for Trevor Noah on his journey, on how he does his work, on how he sees the world? He's touring these days when he's not in the studio in New York doing the show, just kicking off a tour that will have him out and about a lot right through the summer. On his TV special, Trevor Noah Lost in Translation, this was last year, he talked about the time he told his mother he would be hosting The Daily Show. And here's how he relayed that exchange.
I'm on the phone with her. I'm like, oh, Mom, I don't know if you heard, I'm going to be on The Daily Show. And she's like, oh, my baby, I'm so excited. Oh, praise Jesus. This is wonderful. Well done, baby. I'm so happy for you. And did you hear what happened to your brother? I'm like, no, what happened? She's like, oh, he's on the student council at his school. Oh, I'm so excited. Both my boys are doing big things in the world. I'm so happy. Oh. And I was like, yeah, some things are bigger than others.
Trevor Noah from his comedy special Lost in Translation. On the show, he's deep in it now. 10 days ago, Donald Trump had all but wrapped up the Republican nomination. Ted Cruz, John Kasich dropped out of the race. Trevor Noah talked on The Daily Show about the direction of America.
When I first started The Daily Show, a lot of people ask me the same question. They'd be like, hey, are you ready, Trevor? Are you ready for American politics? Are you ready for this election cycle? The Daily Show's a big... Are you ready? But now, seeing all of this happen, I think I should have asked if you were ready. Because I'm from a third world country, it looks like you're headed to one.
Trevor Noah joins us from New York. What do you see in this election campaign season? Did you ever imagine it could be so out there?
I don't think I ever believed in a limitation on how out there an election could be.
Okay.
You know, that's that's one of the joys of coming
Let
from
it go.
a third world country and a mad continent, you know. Yeah, I guess it's a lot of the same for me. Strangely enough, that was one of the first things when I came to the U.S. That's how we got to the piece that we did on the show, which was Donald Trump is an African dictator. Yeah. And that was – everyone asked me the same question. They said, Trevor, I mean Donald Trump, he must be the craziest thing you've ever seen. He must be – you've probably never seen anything like this. And I said, no, if anything, he reminds me of home. You know, I don't think he's the wrong leader. He's just on the wrong continent. You know, he reminds me of an African dictator, and he really is. He, you know, he's bombastic, he's braggadocious, he's driven by money and pride, and you know, a total disregard of women, and he is exactly what I'm used to. So for me, I guess I did imagine this type of election. I just didn't imagine it in this place.
Here's that exchange. This was October.
Trump is so African presidential, he's already at the level of Zimbabwe's president, Robert Mugabe, whose brutality and repressive tactics have kept him in power for 35 years.
My people have great praise for me.
People love me. Everybody loves me.
The little man.
He's very low energy.
Land is ours. It's not European. It's our land. And we have taken it.
We'll take our country back.
We will win. We will be winning all the time.
We will have so much winning if I get elected that you may get bored with winning.
Does it still look like that to you, Trevor? He said he's going to be more presidential now.
No, I don't know what more presidential means. I'm often amused by how low Trump has set the bar and sometimes how low the media looks to that bar, you know, or how often they look to that. I mean, Trump says, I'm being more presidential. He has a speech where he reads words and holds himself back from throwing a few insults. And immediately the coverage on the news is Trump pivoting to more presidential? Is he? No. He's pivoting to civil. Presidential is still a long way away from that. I think policy determines presidential, you know. Plans determine presidential. But I think we've gotten to the place where we get so distracted by the fanfare. And it really is a reality show that Donald Trump is brilliant at creating. And so people have forgotten what a lot of these words and these ideas mean.
Can you describe, Trevor, the Soweto that you grew up in? I mean, you sound so polished. You're right there on our TV screens. And yet, this was not an easy environment. We see Soweto, and I think a lot of mine go all the way back to the apartheid era. When you were a child, what was it like? How rough was it or not rough? Set us straight on the environment of your youth.
Well, I guess Soweto was a very interesting place. I mean, it was a vibrant area, you know, because everywhere in the world, when people have tried to quash a culture or a group of people, inevitably what you find you do is you galvanize them. And so what happened in Soweto was the apartheid government placed all of the black people, you know, they wanted a working force, but they didn't want them in the cities. And so these people were moved to Soweto and people built a life there.
And it so was, we see it as kind of giant slum in Johannesburg. Is that how it reads or read when you were there?
No. Soweto has changed tremendously because, mm-hmm. you know, people want to grow. People yes. want to move forward. You know, if anything, the apartheid government went against or they proved their own theory wrong. They based their whole premise on the idea that black people have no ability or no interest in self-governing nor in progress. Mm-hmm. And yet that's exactly what Soweto was. People built from nothing. And it was one of the most vibrant places to grow up in. It was a melting pot of different African cultures. You know, I talked to journalists from the US, from the UK, white journalists who mm-hmm. came to South Africa, and they said they found that Johannesburg during that time had more of a depressing feel. The city had an ominous cloud hanging over it. Mm. And yet Soweto had a life. It was a life that existed despite the oppression. It was a life that existed despite the impoverishment. And I mean, that's something, the resolve of the people, I think, was galvanized because of where they were. And, you know, when you have nothing and you are at the bottom, then you can only aim up, and up is where you will go.
I mean, I read here that your mom was a mixture of Xhosa. I guess it's
Xhosa.
Xhosa.
So that's one of the cliques.
Xhosa. Okay. And Jewish ancestry, your dad's Swiss and German, and that you their relationship was actually illegal when you were created.
Yes. Yes, that's correct. Interracial relationships were not permitted in South Africa. That was against the law. So many times my mom got arrested if she was caught with my father fraternizing in any way, you know, and she would get arrested and she'd spend a bit of time in jail and then she'd have to pay a fine, which was often a few months' salary. And then my dad was given a warning because he was a white man. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he was seen to be, dabbling as opposed to committing a crime. Mm. And my mom was seen as a criminal. And so I was born a product of this union, you know, and they weren't allowed to be married. They weren't allowed to be together. But my mom always believed in breaking the rules. She said, it's my country. It's my body. It's my love. And I don't think we'll allow anyone to control what we can or cannot do. And there were many people who did this in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, how apartheid ended, really.
What about for you? Were you able to be with your father, to spend the day with him, to hang out in the streets or not?
No, not in the streets. No, not in the streets at all. I couldn't walk with my mom in the streets. You know, I've made jokes about that, but
why not? Because you were clearly mixed race more than her, or why?
Yeah. So my mom is black, and then because I'm mixed race, I'm a lot lighter skinned than her. So that's a dead giveaway. If you saw us walking down the street, you immediately knew that something had happened. I'm a manifestation of the crime, and so. My mom wouldn't walk with me as my mom. Oftentimes, she would masquerade as my nanny. And then she would get a friend of hers who was my skin color to act like she was my mom. And then, you know, you'd maintain that facade for the authorities. So, but most of the time I spent indoors. You know, if I was in Soweto, for instance, my grandmother wouldn't even let me outside because if the police found me, then I would just be taken away to an orphanage because, you know, if children from mixed marriages could be confiscated and taken away by the authorities, put in an orphanage and then tried to be adopted off to other families. So, luckily for me as a child, I didn't know what game we were playing. You know, if you tell your child to go hide or to stay indoors, they just think these are the rules. I didn't know that there was an oppressive regime that was creating this. If anything, I thought my mom was the oppressive regime. So I was having a great time. I was living a wonderful life because I was loved, and I guess everyone was working towards something.
Eventually, your mom married. She remarried. She had trouble, particularly with one of those men who could be brutal with her. You witnessed that.
Yeah.
And that's a story in itself. But out of all that, you seem to come out so buoyant and bright spirited. Where does that come from, Trevor?
I think that's a product of my mom. That's a product of my country. You know, my mom and myself and our family, we went through a very tough time. You know, growing up in a home where there's domestic abuse, many people, you know, suffer in silence. And it's strange how in society the victims are often more embarrassed about what is happening. You know, women don't come forward, and even if they do come forward, people treat them as if they are the pariah. And that's something I witnessed firsthand. But my mom was stronger than that. You know, she was out there. She was loud. You know, when police wouldn't help, or my mom didn't let that get to her. But more important than all of that was she always used humor as her tool, and that's the world I grew up in. And my mom was always laughing. She was always making a joke about things that many people didn't think you could make a joke about. So, I mean, you know, through the abuse, through the tirades, you know, both on a small scale domestically, and then even within the country, you did find that laughter was really the best medicine. And even as a nation, that's what happened to us in South Africa. Nelson Mandela, for instance, was one of the funniest people I've ever come across in my life. And he spent 27 years in prison, and he was making jokes. He was telling jokes in prison. Yeah. He was telling jokes when he came out of prison. And my favorite, I remember being at a press conference, and Nelson Mandela was there. And they were launching his face on the Kruger Rands, you know, the golden coins. Mm-hmm. And he made a joke, but nobody laughed because everyone thought it was Nelson Mandela. So everything he says has to be inspirational. So someone, a British journalist, asked him. They said, Mr. Mandela, how does it feel going from being labeled a terrorist to now having your face on the currency of that same country? And Mandela looked over at him and he said, that's how you know you've made it, when you have your own money. No more associating with poor people. And everyone in the room just kept quiet. No, and I laughed from the back, and they looked at me like I had made a mistake. And it was just such – it was a great joke, just the idea that Nelson Mandela would be superficial, and as soon as he's got his money, he's out. Yeah. I thought that was hilarious. Yeah. And that theme, I think, has always been in my life, and that is you have to find a reason to laugh. And I think a lot of the time – laughter doesn't diminish what is happening. Laughter doesn't dismiss what is happening. But what it does is it doesn't give a negative thing the power over you. It doesn't give it the full power to hamper or impede your ability to live life.
Take a call from New Orleans. Cha-Cha is calling. Cha-Cha, you are on the air with Trevor Noah.
Hi, Tom. Trevor, I am stupefied at your success. You are doing so well. In fact, I am shocked and chagrined at how the country has embraced you. My question to you is, I want to know, and because I also live in America, coming from Kenya, I want to know, what does giving back look like to you? Giving back to Soweto, what does that look like to you? What do you do?
Interesting. Oh. Trevor?
What does giving back look like to me? I think I look at giving back on multiple levels. So on the most basic level, I give back financially because I've been blessed enough to have money. And so I give back financially. You know, I'm involved in children's hospitals in South Africa and work through the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund there, and then also the Ubuntu Education Fund, because those are the two biggest things I've always believed in, is just the children and then also education. You know, through education, anything is possible. That's the biggest thing my family focused on, and I saw the results. And then I also believe in giving back time. So when I have time, I go down to South Africa and different parts of Africa as well and get involved in any project I can, you know, whether it's AIDS education, whether it's helping victims of domestic abuse. You know, there's a soccer project that is in South Africa that helps young girls, and you know, it's called Grassroots Soccer, and I help them when I have time. And then I guess on a metaphorical level, I just try and be proud to be me. You know, it's very easy to be afraid to be yourself. Mm-hmm. I understand how tough it can be, especially coming to the US, where there has been sentiment at time of xenophobia, which we see now more than ever, but I felt it as well. And you know, it's easy to try and, I guess, sidestep that feeling and try and assimilate as much as you can. But being proud of who you are and representing not just your country and your continent, I think, is one of the biggest ways I try to give back. So that people back home go, hey, this is not my world. My world is larger than what I've been led to believe. Mm-hmm. So I maintain that. I say yes. I have an accent that some people think is strange. I say a few words funny. I say controversy, and then people are like, people are like, are you supposed to say controversy? Mm. And I'm like, well, that's just how I say it. So I accept these things, and I try and give back in as many ways as I can.
Chacha, thanks for your call. One more. Bob in Boston. You're on the air with Trevor Noah, Bob.
Hey, Trevor. I got to say, I was a little incredulous when I heard the announcement of your hiring, but I think you are doing a fabulous job.
Thank you so much,
Rob. To you. And I got to say, in this political season, this goes without saying, but The Daily Show is needed more than ever. And I mean that sincerely. But I just want to know if you address just one bit of criticism, and I think it's sort of unfair criticism, but I'll say it anyway, that I read somewhere that was leveled at you, which is that with Jon Stewart, because he's an American, when he would joke about popular culture, you know, and the media, politics, was sort of like a family member joking about the other people in his family, you know, mm-hmm. easy to laugh at. But when it's you doing it from another country, it's sort of like a neighbor from down the street poking fun at a family down the street. It's like funny, but maybe just a little awkward and a little maybe less funny because it's not his own family. I don't know if I've really articulated that.
We got it, Bob. Our time is short before the break. Take it away, Trevor.
I agree with you completely, Bob, but I have found that families can grow and, you know, neighbors can become part of a neighborhood. So one of the biggest things I found is that's why I got on the road in the U.S. is to become more than just a neighbor. I'm living in America. I always tell people, I go, I'm going through the same things that many people are going through. You know, if I'm driving through the streets of New York, I suffer the potholes as much as anybody else. So if anything, I suffer through the same things. And so I feel like we can find camaraderie in our joint suffering. And then we laugh together.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and here's how it opens 4 nights a week on Comedy Central.
From Comedy Central's World News Headquarters in New York, this is The Daily Show with Trevor Noah.
And then, the man himself.
Welcome to The Daily Show. I'm Trevor Noah. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you so much.
Where's it going to go? It goes where the news goes. In January, he took on the Flint water crisis, joking about a news report about the low cost of preventing the Flint crisis in the first place if only the city had spent the money to add anti-corrosives to the water.
The fix was about $100 a day. All of this could have been avoided for just that small amount of money.
$100 a day. Why didn't you say something? I want to call out to all my people in Africa right now watching The Daily Show.
Because, my friends, for only $100 a day, we can save a village in America and get these people drinking the water that they so badly need.
Trevor Noah, my guest in January on The Daily Show. You can join us this hour. What's your question for Trevor Noah as a multiracial South African guy about how he sees this country, politics in this country, race in this country, about how he sees American life? Travis in Gaffney, South Carolina, you're on with Trevor Noah.
Yes, sir. Hi, Tom. This is Travis. I just wanted to call and just say, you know, Trevor, I think you're doing a great job.
Thank you, Travis.
I enjoy listening to your show, and I think it's interesting the way that you articulate your words and explain your point of view. I enjoy listening to your show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Fantastic. Yes, thanks, Travis. Trevor, what's easy to get at in the American scene now? What's hard to get at? You know, what's shooting? What is it? The ducks in a barrel? And what's trickier?
I think what's easy to get at is Trump. I mean, Trump right now, and you know, the clown car that was the Republican circus. You know, the whole nomination process, everything that was happening in the race. That was really easy to shoot at. But in terms of what's hard to get at is the nuance. I find that's probably one of the biggest things that we have to work towards is rebuilding nuance in America. You know, conversations have more than just two sides, or the two sides may both have differing but equally valid and correct opinions. And so, you know, when dealing with that, how do you engage in those conversations? And you find that it's tough because America's become so partisan that either side doesn't want to hear anything the other side says. Oftentimes, people take the opposing view just because the other side has done the opposite. And so I think that's the toughest thing, is trying to get to a point where you go, hey, I know that person comes from the other side or the side that you don't agree with, but they may be right when it comes to this, or can you see this from their point of view? And that's where it gets tricky and interesting. And that's something I will always work towards, because I do believe one of the biggest things you need to do is see your opposition, or even who you consider your enemy, you have to see them as human beings first, and then you can understand how to argue or to disagree with them. See their point of view in order to understand how to argue against it, which is not the easiest thing in the world.
Nuance. Interesting. Here was your predecessor, this is Jon Stewart, one more time on the David Axelrod show, asked what he would be saying about Hillary Clinton if he still hosted the show.
What I think about Hillary Clinton is, you know, I imagine to be a very bright woman without the courage of her convictions, because I'm not even sure what they are.
Are you saying, Trevor Noah, that you want to be more nuanced than Jon Stewart?
No, I'm saying the conversations we need to tackle, the difficult ones are the nuanced ones. You know, I think John was really good at spotting that. You know, he's someone that's one thing I was admired about John, was he operated in the space of just going for the truth. You know, and it's tough, because sometimes you find that the truth contradicts your truth. So that nuance is the gray, the blurring between the black and white. Can you see the other side of an argument, and are you willing to poke fun at yourself when you maybe hold incorrect views that you've believed for a long time?
Lynn in Bridgehampton, New York, you're on with Trevor Noah. Thanks for calling, Lynn.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Tom and
hi.
Trevor. I just wanted to add to the heaps of praise that Trevor is deservedly receiving. And just from a little different perspective, I have had quite an international life throughout my career. So back here on Long Island, it's a little different. And I really enjoy the depth of experience that comes through, Trevor, in your delivery and your point of view. And I don't know how much of this you write. I'm sure you write some, if not a lot of it. But I just love it, and I look forward to seeing you every night that you're on. I work all day. I'm freelance,
thank
and I make
so
sure
much.
I'm in front
thank
of that
you.
TV at 11 o'clock. I wouldn't miss a minute.
Thank you so much.
Lynn, we've got it. We heard Jon Stewart on Hillary Clinton. Here's a little bit from Trevor Noah. This was just Wednesday. Here he was mocking Bernie Sanders supporters who said they would support Trump over Hillary Clinton.
43% of Sanders voters said they'll defect to Trump in the fall if Clinton is the nominee.
Wow. What? I mean,
I knew some of Bernie's voters were young, but I didn't realize they were children. I was just like, fine, I'm just going to go vote for Trump. Hillary's stupid and she smells like Benghazi.
Do you weigh out how much humor or cutting you direct each night at the two parties? Do you have a scale down in the writer's room where they say, okay, we've got about half a show on Trump and now let's do half a show on Sanders and Clinton, or do you pay no attention?
No, I think we do. You know, the biggest thing is trying to find the news right now, though. That's the toughest thing. You know, Trump is... He is completely consuming and looming figure on every single news network that you watch. So it's sometimes just finding the coverage or a story that is being reported on. But I find the funny on all sides. I think that we can point it out on all sides. A lot of the time, we forget that we are the people and then there are the politicians and they govern every aspect of our lives, you know, and sometimes they trick us into believing that they're completely on our sides. And this is all over the world. So I do like to poke fun at both sides, which you know, sometimes doesn't go down well, but that's what comedy is.
We played a little bit earlier of you equating Trump with saying he was familiar from African dictators that you had observed or known. What do you mean by that exactly? What's the linkage?
Well, if you look at African dictators, you look at how a lot of them rose to power. What happens is they rise up through a revolution. So they find a moment in time where the populace is disenfranchised. Maybe there's been a shift in power. Maybe there's been a vacuum. But something in their lives over time has changed. And those people feel like they need a revolution. Somebody comes up and says they will provide the said revolution. And then this person oftentimes is somebody who, you know, is interested in self-worth and self-grandeur. And what happens is the people gravitate towards that because there are promises that that will somehow extend to them. And this person keeps on doing that. And over time, people are even willing to relinquish many of their liberties and many of the things that they believe in for what they perceive is the pursuit of a freedom or a greater existence. And when that person gets into power, you find none of that happens. But you've already relinquished everything. And it takes many, many, many years, many decades most of the time, sometimes until the death of the dictator, sometimes even beyond their death, to rectify that. And you see that in Trump's rhetoric, you know, blaming the problems on people where there are no real problems, you know, going, you know, they're taking over our country. That's not true. More Mexican immigrants are leaving America than coming into America. So these numbers are not true. You know, they're criminals, they're rapists. It's like, no, but more of them are not. In fact, they are less likely to be involved in crime than a natural-born American citizen. So, you know, it's a rhetoric that it's demagoguery, really. And what you're doing is you're going around demagoguing and saying to people, I can play to your fears and I can help you. But the truth is there will be no help because it's all built on a foundation of sand.
Cindy in Burlington, Vermont. You're on with Trevor Noah, Cindy.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Trevor. You're doing a fantastic job.
Thank you.
One of the things that comes through to me loud and clear is the extent of racism you have personally encountered, and I wonder what your take on race relations in the United States is right now. I'm the mom of a multiracial son in a mostly white state that is pretty progressive, but I see and hear things all of the time that I feel that the racists are becoming emboldened.
Yes,
lately.
Definitely. Definitely. Wow, you see, that's again with race and racism, it's so multi-layered, I find. You know, there is the very basic on the surface racism, you are this, I am that, therefore I hate you or I throw slurs your way. And then there is systemic racism. Then there's racism that exists within the very fabric of how the country is run. You know, laws that have been created or systems that have been designed and to unfortunately disenfranchise certain groups of people. You see that, and it still exists today. You know, it's in things like voter ID laws. You look at, you know, gerrymandering, and you look at how people are given their voice or have their voice taken away. So there's so many levels when it comes to racism in the U.S. And it's the same in South Africa and in many places in the world. I think the key is to have discussions. And I think, again, the key is for both sides to have discussions between human beings, which is very tough. I will always acknowledge it is tough, especially if you come from a world where you have been oppressed for a long time. At some point you go, I'm tired of being nice. I'm tired of being diplomatic. I want to fight now. And it's like, yes, but are you in the position to have that fight, and what will that fight achieve? And so, you know, it's a tough world to be in. But as you said, and I guess that is the light, you know, the canary in the mine is the fact that you are in a liberal state. You are in a place where it is predominantly white, and yet you find there is acceptance. And I think we need to keep on growing that acceptance. We can't always focus on the people that are often the loudest and a lot of the time the minority. There are many more good people than there are bad people, I believe. It's just that bad people are very, very loud, especially on Twitter.
Especially on Twitter. Trevor, can you – there are many streets in America, but with your racial profile, can you compare, contrast for us what it's like to walk down a street in South Africa versus a street in the United States? Maybe several different – I mean, I know it's not – you know, there's not just one street here, but what's the experience like living in your skin here in racial identity terms or versus there these days?
It depends. It depends on where you are. I like to say that America is a continent masquerading as a country. You know, it's so different. Every state you go to, every city you go to feels like a completely different world. New York City is unlike any other city in America. You walk down the streets in New York, it doesn't matter what color you are, black, white, you know, Indian, purple. Mm-hmm. And I have seen some purple people. They don't care. It's I've never, ever seen anything like it. To get noticed in New York City requires, I mean, I think, I don't even know what it would require.
Trump Tower. I've seen people walk,
yeah, but even that fits into the landscape, yeah. Everything, you know. So it depends on where you go. It's the same in South Africa. If you go to Johannesburg and you walk around, there is no – it's a cosmopolitan city. It is the melting pot of our country, you know, and you travel to different parts. You will feel racial disparity in certain parts more than other parts. You'll go – there is a huge income inequality in some places, and you'll feel it more than other places. But I really do find myself feeling at home in the U.S. because – it genuinely does remind me of home. It's in many ways exactly like South Africa. It's just you have more variations on cereal.
Exactly like South Africa, meaning you feel the history of racial divide here, even in a present that is made some kind of progress.
Yeah, definitely. You will always find that. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I guess that's just a human thing. We will always find reasons to hate. You know, and we will, you know, as people, we over time, you see it all through time. People have looked for reasons to separate and hate one another. So you feel that tension in the U.S. You feel the disparity, but you also feel the inclusion in a lot of places. And I say that's why it's important to focus on the good as much as the bad, because sometimes people get hit over the head so much with the racism, the racism. That people don't take a moment to just go, hey, you know, there's also some beautiful things happening here. It's the same in New York City. I never understood why New Yorkers are so angry. And then I lived here for months, and I remember one day just going, wait, I'm becoming like them. You got to remember sometimes to just stop and look around and go, this is amazing. Look at this. Yeah, the roads may be horrible, but look at this amazing landscape. Look at the people. Look at the bustling metropolis. Go to the parks. See the good that exists within the bad. And oftentimes we hone in on the bad, and we focus on that, and that becomes what we define our experience as. And I think there's a lot more to it than that. So South Africa and the U.S. have that. Yes, there is racial tension. Yes, it'll always be there. But over time, I feel like it will dissolve, and people won't even realize that it's happening.
One more quick call for you, Suzanne, in Atlanta, Georgia. Suzanne, just half a minute. You're on with Trevor.
Yes, hi, Tom. Hi, Trevor. Thanks for taking my call. I relate a lot with everything Trevor is talking. I'm a big fan. He's funny. He's intelligent because, I mean, Trevor, you have a broader view of matter beyond the USA. And also, you bring some light on many misconceptions of the African continent. Low disclosure, I'm from Africa. You can tell from my accent.
Maybe, yeah.
So you make us, yeah, you make us all proud, and just keep it up. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Suzanne. Thanks for calling. And when you take it on the road, is it a very different show from what we see on air, Trevor?
Yeah, I don't think it's a very different show, but I think it's a much broader show, you know, because The Daily Show, I feel, has a purpose. You know, we're trying to provide catharsis and I guess some light in the madness. But the stand-up, really, it's everything and it's for everyone. I perform for families and kids and people who are not political. There's, you know, relationship jokes all the way through to stuff about Donald Trump and just stuff about my world. So I go, come and laugh. We learn together. We laugh together. And when you laugh together, you realize that there's more that brings you together than what separates you.
Trevor Noah. He's on the road tonight in Foxwoods in New London, Connecticut, and then right on across the U.S. and over to Europe as well. Host of The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. Really fun.
Thank you.
So
I really
much.
Appreciate it. And thank you to the callers and to everyone listening. Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.